Hi everyone, this is Laura Smith, SLP Mommy of Apraxia, and I'm here with my special panel that I did last year. So grateful for all of these ladies who are incredibly busy for us to get together and find a time to bring you a special Apraxia Awareness Day video. So I want to welcome Carrie Ebert, Amy Graham, and Jenny Biorum, all SLPs specializing in childhood apraxia speech. So welcome everybody.
Good to see you.
Thanks for having us.
So what I wanted to make this talk about today is I know that all of us have our social media handles. So, you know, Carrie Ebert has Carrie Ebert Seminars, Graham Speech Therapy is Amy's, and Biorum Publications, and anything Biorum. I think you have a few accounts, Jenny, to follow Jenny. And then me, SLP Mommy of Apraxia. We all get inbox messages frequently, and we welcome them from parents and SLPs asking about, you know, childhood apraxia speech. And so we thought today we could talk about, you know, the topics that are most frequently in our inbox and kind of address them in this format. So Carrie, we're going to start with you because it makes sense. Early intervention is kind of your jam, and that's where our little babies start.
That's right. That's right. Yes. So I've been an SLP for 25 years, 20 of those have been in early intervention. Toddlers are my favorite human beings on the planet. And I have never really worked with school age kids. I do see some 3 to 5 year olds, but my real love is working with those toddlers. And so I think when we start talking about childhood apraxia of speech and early intervention, the birth to three period of time, it can be a little tricky because we're getting these kiddos referred to us who are either pre-verbal or minimally verbal, and they're toddlers, right? So, you know, there's a lot of people who say, you can't diagnose apraxia until they're three. And I'm like, okay, well, we need to have a talk here, first of all, because there's nothing magical about age three. If I could tell you guys how many times I've had a parent email me and like tell me their story. So my son is 35 months old and he's going to get his apraxia diagnosed next month after he's three. But, you know, and I'm just like, what happens at three that all of a sudden magically you
can magic?
Yeah, it's magic. You know, you put three birthday candles, voila, he has apraxia.
The apraxia fairy came and
the apraxia fairy.
So
I just want to make sure parents, SLPs understand it's not the age. Now, Dave Hammer and I wrote our book. And one of the things we talked about in there is the 2 to 3 year age range is far and away the most challenging age to diagnose anything. Do you know what I mean? Well, no matter what
for sure
discipline you are as a therapist. Okay, there it is. Thanks, Jenny.
Fabulous book, by the way. Honestly, so good.
Thank you. But so it's so important to understand that while toddlers are very difficult to assess and differentially diagnose, I love you, Jenny. And it doesn't mean that at three, something magical happens. Here's what the child has to be able to do. They have to have attention, motivation, and verbal imitation skills so that they can participate, at least attempt to participate in a dynamic motor speech evaluation. Okay. So are there some 33-month-old toddlers who are able to do those things, who are communication risk takers, who can get a diagnosis of CAS? Jenny, Amy, what do you guys think? I mean, yeah, of course, right? But are there also some five-year-olds who really don't have the motivation, the attention, and the ability to verbally imitate? Are there some five-year-olds where we can't give a diagnosis? Of course there are.
Absolutely.
So I think from my perspective as an early intervention provider, that's one thing I really want to hit home is that with toddlers, most of the time, or anytime you're working with minimally verbal children, we are talking about something called suspected childhood apraxia of speech. We're not talking about this full-blown diagnosis of CAS. One of the things, though, that I talk about in my continuing education seminars is it is always better to use a motor-based approach. If you're not sure if this is CAS or not, and I just want to explain to SLPs why, right? Because we're all nodding, yes, use motor. Why? Because speech is a motor skill. Right? Language isn't motor. Speech is a motor skill. And so if you use a motor-based approach, if you use principles of motor learning and the child ends up not having CAS, you're not going to do any harm because speech is a motor skill. So it's not like you're going to like slow down progress. Once I realize, ooh, this is phonological, might I switch to like a cycles approach or, you know, minimal pairs or maximal oppositions? Absolutely. But for right now, when they're minimally verbal, I don't know exactly what's going on. For me to suspect CAS, this very young child must have some of those features from the research by Overby, Kasperi, and Schreiber, right? The 2019 research that said, hey, here are the six or seven things that we should be seeing, you know, in kids with CAS. So obviously we're suspecting it, but if I don't use a motor-based approach, if I'm like, hey, I'm just going to stimulate language. I'm going to read to the child. I'm going to talk to the child. I'm going to sing to the child. I'm going to stimulate, and I'm going to use self-talk and parallel talk and all these great language strategies. And guess what? You know what's going to happen? Receptive language will grow. Here's expressive, right? Here's talking. This is what happens. Receptive language continues to grow. Play skills continue to grow, and this remains static. And so now this gap between receptive and expressive language that was already here at 25 months old, now guess what? At 36 months old, this is what's happened. And now we've got a kid with behaviors. He's hitting, biting, pinching, shoving, screaming because he can't make himself understood. He can't communicate effectively enough. And so it is so important that we just go ahead and use that motor-based approach when we suspect CAS, because
hey,
we
Carrie,
can't do
can I ask you a question?
Please
so
do.
For purposes of clarification, because I know even among SLPs, there's some confusion when we say motor-based.
Yes. I was going to say the same thing.
Oral motor-based.
Oh, no.
Uh-oh. Oh, she went there. She went there.
Confusion sometimes. So,
oh, I'm so I can share the Mr. Tongue story if you want me to.
Why is it that I never contemplated that's where people would go? Like in my brain, when I hear motor-based approach, I think principles of motor
learning.
You know what I mean? Right. PML. I think the tutorial from Dr.
Edwin Moss.
Moss from 2008, I think it was. Yep.
I didn't go there either, Carrie. So Amy, thank you. But
okay. No, I'm not talking anything oral motor. What I'm talking about is principles of motor learning, which is how all four of us focus our therapy when we're working with children with apraxia, which means that we can't go into principles of motor learning today. Like that's a whole
so
other topic.
That would be, this is an inbox of mine frequently. Where did you learn the principles of motor learning, Laura? And at this point, this is such a hard question for me because I've been immersed in it now for a very long time that I don't know the one thing that made it click. I mean, I've taken so many, like you said, Edwin Moss has that 2008 article that's fabulous, but I wouldn't say a speech person might necessarily, unless someone explained it to them, transfer it to speech. Right. You know, I took, I don't know. What do you guys think? Where you, actually, Amy, I feel like that Moss article did help you, right? Like, how did you really?
Tremendously. I feel like it's understanding, like when you understand, when we say principles of motor learning, you first need to identify what those principles are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so if you know what the principles are, like more is better, right? More practice. If you want to learn something if you want to learn how to do something motorically, you have to do it a whole bunch of times.
Yeah. So, I mean, think about a sport that you don't play.
Right.
I mean, I think about golf and tennis for me. I'm like, what would I have to do to learn how to swing a tennis racket or a golf?
You actually have to have the tennis racket in your hand and you have to swing it. Right. Just like if you want to learn how to produce speech, you have to practice speech, which kind of goes back to that oral motor versus we're actually, when we say motor practice, we're talking speech practice.
Right.
But those,
right.
you know, those principles of motor learning are many, 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 many trials, accurate trials per session.
And fewer number of targets.
Fewer number.
Right, Jenny, that's something we always talk about. I'd rather
absolutely.
Get 50 repetitions of one word in a 10-minute segment of speech therapy than two repetitions of 25 words, right?
Yep.
That's based on principles of motor learning. But when we do our tick therapy, what do? We use a set of super duper our tick flashcards and we go through and maybe have them say them each two, three times. That's not principles of motor learning.
No.
The other big thing that I know that Jenny and I have talked about a lot is prosody. How important is it that we vary the way those words, Amy, you've done so many videos of showing, you know, you have to vary the way the target words are practiced. That's based on principles.
Okay, so, but Carrie, the question then still remains. All of us can explain it to anyone when we all do workshops and conferences doing that. Where do people go? Because this is such an inbox question.
Continuing education. Here, that's the thing though.
Right,
you
right.
Guys, if they're not teaching it in grad school. I mean, when did you guys graduate? I graduated in 95. When did you guys graduate?
99.
99. What about you, Laura?
I don't want to tell you guys. I'm 08, but still I didn't. So 08. Okay. Let's just go with that. I didn't learn it in 08.
Okay.
So
I didn't learn it.
No, I didn't either.
If I ran the world, can I just tell you, if I ran the world, what would be happening? all four of us would be adjunct faculty at every communication disorders program, and we would be doing Zoom and we would be teaching an apraxia course. Like, that is really how the world should be run, instead of professors who maybe are tenured and haven't taken continuing education.
Well, I like that advice, Carrie, because I think a lot of SLPs come out of school and they get their C's and they're told, you are the expert in all communication disorders from birth through the life cycle to geriatrics and every single thing that you learned. And you guys, we're all here to tell you it's not true. And all of us admit that we are not experts in other things either. You know, we took continuing ed, we found a focus of interest, and we took continuing ed in that so that we can become competent therapists for this specific disability.
And I even stopped calling myself an expert, because I feel like I specialize in it because it's my passion and it's my interest. But I think that I continue to learn. When I learn from you guys, every time I see Dr.
Yeah, it's so true.
I don't know that I'm ever going to be like the most knowledgeable person on CAS, because I think that once you hit that point and decide you're going to stop learning, that's where you run into problems. So I feel like while I specialize in autism and apraxia and early intervention, I've stopped using the term expert altogether, you know, just because that's just something I've started doing recently.
I would say specialist.
Yeah. That I specialize in it, just meaning it's my deep passion. I mean, I'm fascinated with apraxia. I am, you know.
I had a mentor once that said, Laura, if you reach a point ever in your career where you think you know it all, retire and do everyone a favor.
Just go away.
Do everyone a favor. I love that. Okay, so right. I know we need to move on. I know I didn't talk a lot about toddlers, but I just want to mention, because my son is autistic, I do also get a lot of questions about, well, what if they are autistic and they have CAS? Does that ever happen to you guys?
All the time.
Okay, so there's a reason why, and I know I'm not here to like pimp my materials, but I am going to pimp this because this is my new autism program. And as an early intervention provider, here's what happens. A child gets referred, a toddler gets referred to early intervention because guess what? He's not talking, right? He's not talking. Okay. So an SLP from early intervention goes and does this evaluation. And I'm like, oh yeah, I get that he's not talking, but my bigger concern is that he's missing those foundation skills for learning and development. Okay. So I've identified 5 foundation skills that absolutely have to be present before we can really focus on talking. So everybody's concerned because he's not talking. And I'm like, but wait, he has no nonverbal imitation skills. That is an absolute critical foundation skill. Oh geez, he has no joint attention. He doesn't even know I'm in the same room with him. Right? He doesn't even forget eye contact. I'm not even talking about eye contact. I'm talking about engagement, right? If you don't have a child engage with you, you remember in grad school, they'd throw a kid in who had no joint attention. And here I am like this grad student. And I'm like, I don't know what to do. I'm like, you know, trying to do the pony show, you know, with Mr. Potato. And I'm like, eyes, hat, nose. We're chasing this kid around there. I'm like, I can't get his attention. Like, what are we doing? Why do we have speech goals if a child doesn't have joint?
Yeah. Really important message there. Looks like Carrie froze.
The whole sensory piece, self-regulation. I'm telling you, if children aren't in a ready state for learning, right? So we need that self-regulation. If they aren't in a ready state for learning, speech therapy is not going to be very effective, right? We're not going to work on talking. Purposeful play, okay? It's really important that kids can learn through play. Autistic kids have play skills that are different from neurotypical play. Absolutely. It doesn't mean we're trying to change their play, but it means we have to be able to have them learn through play. So I have to help them develop some purposeful play skills. And then the fifth foundation skill that I address is early language.
Yeah.
Not speech, early language. AAC, we have to get some kind of communication in there. We have to focus on that. And then once I have attention, some nonverbal imitation, once we have some established language, guess what? Then we can start talking about speech goals.
Exactly.
Not until, okay?
That's awesome. That leads us really into Amy and what you do with your differential diagnosis then. And that's equally as important to know what we're dealing with here.
It is. When I go around talking about, you know, interventions, I get asked all the time to speak. Can you tell us about phonological interventions, articulation interventions, apraxia interventions? And because I've been doing this, like, I don't know if I've said, but I specialize in speech sound disorders. So I have the whole gamut, like articulation. Yes. I got lispers, I got residual R errors, and I've got all the way down the spectrum from phonological disorders to apraxia. But my first every presentation I give is always starts with diagnosis and differential diagnosis, because the type of intervention that we choose is dependent upon what we believe the underlying issue is to the child's speech disorder. Because if a child has a phonological disorder or a phonological delay, we use different types of interventions. And if a child has apraxia, I'm not going to use cycles. I'm not going to use multiple oppositions. I'm not going to use minimal pairs. And I'm certainly not going to use an articulation approach, right, which is, we were talking earlier, that's at the phonetic level where we're trying to get this one sound really accurate. That's with our kids who have lisps or R's or lateral lisps.
Which you love, which cracks me up. I'm not a fan. I just refer them to you.
Love the lateral list. But yeah, so it's like, that's the level we're working at for articulation. Phonology, we're working at these patterns we only have to work on maybe a few words to maybe if we're working on S cluster reduction, 3 to 5 words on whatever different kinds of intervention approach we're using, and that's going to generalize. Kids with apraxia, it's not phonological. It's not phonetic. It is motor based. I know I talk with my hands a lot. It is motor. Like, these are those kids over here who, it's not about the sound. It's about putting those sounds together.
Movement.
And moving movement. From sound to sound and syllable to syllable. So that's what we're talking about when we're talking about these principles of motor learning, because if they want to say their first name, and the object is like, they have all these sounds in their repertoire, like, great, but it's the problem is just moving fluidly from sound to sound and syllable to syllable to produce intelligible speech. So that's kind of the difference. But again, it goes back to differential diagnosis. You have to figure out what it is.
So here's another question, Amy, I get is, okay, can a kid have both?
Yes.
Okay. So we know they can have both. Then where do you start? Because then a speech therapist.
Motor.
That's right. But exactly.
Motor.
So we're always going to, I want you to speak to it though, but I'm just giving you inbox questions. So
absolutely.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, because I get the question all the time. Now, always from a motor perspective, because we know that if you treat a child with apraxia with a phonological intervention, that's not going to be effective. But if you treat a child with these other articulation phonological deficits from a motor-based perspective, that can be effective for them. Mm-hmm. So it's like, if I always err on the side of treating it from motor-based intervention, because I know it's going to help all my kids. And then once they kind of develop and their speech, they start to acquire more speech, and you can start to tease out, okay, what's really, like what Carrie said, when you treat a child as if, right, suspected childhood apraxia of speech, and then they start getting more speech, and then you can start to tease out, oh, you know what, I think this is more phonological than you can.
Getting more consistent with their errors, right? And so then when you start seeing more consistency with errors, that's when you likely will switch maybe to looking more at patterns.
That can happen with our kids who have these mixed speech sound disorders.
There it is.
Right? They have apraxia. They've got some characteristics of a phonological deficit. But if we're addressing their issue and sounds like it's starting to resolve and they start to sound more consistent, then yes, absolutely. But always, always incorporating principles of motor learning with the way you practice in therapy.
If, you know, I was just in Istanbul and I freely shared my videos. And so the little boy I'm seeing has a history of motor planning, so apraxia. He also has phonological errors, and he also has lateralization, so articulation. So what I would do is I would combine. So if I felt like that was a phonological error or a lateralization error, I would use the principles of motor learning and teach it that articulation error, or I teach that phonological process using DTTC. And so it would help him through the whole process, but I might use a minimal pair and throw it at him. So he's like, you know, I know we were working on the word swing, so that was a blend, but he was having a really hard time getting the vowel correct and getting the whole motor plan for it. So he would say wing, and I'd say, wing, you want a wing? And he would say, no, I said, you want a swing. And so then we go through and do it as a motor plan, but we're still working on that blend, which is more of a phonological process on his, because he drops them all because he's got that cluster reduction. So I was really combining methods. Yes.
Which is really important too, because I have kids who are apraxic and they don't have any S clusters, right? So I'm going to choose maybe some words that are important to them, some really, and I know Jenny, you're going to talk about target selection, I think, but choosing some very few targets and address some S-blends, stick them in there. I mean, if they're stimulable for all those sounds and they're just having trouble, you know, combining them into words, then that's what you need to do.
Yeah,
Go
for it.
So even though I work with toddlers, please, SLPs, don't work on only earliest mastered sounds. Don't do that.
Right.
You're
gonna
work on PBNN and TDNN. And I'm like, freaking A, no. Like, if the kid loves to swing, why would you wait until he's like five to work on the word swing? If his name is, I don't know, or if he loves flowers, I don't know, you know, whatever his favorite things are. Again, this is Jenny's topic, but you guys, don't worry about, are they earlier mastered sounds, later mastered sounds? It's irrelevant, right?
Any sounds. There's all sounds.
So Jenny, go ahead and talk about that, Jenny, because yes, I will tell you too, with my kid, with Ashlyn, it was very interesting. She couldn't say mama, like the M in mama, a bilabial that, as most SLPs know, is early developing. She had an SH. She couldn't say mama, but she could go shoo, shoo, well, shoo. Is she not supposed to have an SH? But why do we work on SH then when she doesn't even have M? So go ahead and speak to your target selection strategy.
All right. Well, I love target selection. It's a huge passion of mine because I think right now what speech therapists are doing in general, and even parents, is that they're making it way too difficult. We're going to simplify. We're going to make it really, really simple. This is not hard. It's not rocket science. It is really, really easy.
But it is science.
It is
science. My husband always says that.
It's just not rocket science.
Right, right.
It is science. But, you know, exactly what Carrie said, we want to focus, and Amy preaches this too. I hear you say it all the time, Amy, is we want to focus on the sounds the child does have in the repertoire, not the sounds they don't have. I could give a rat's what if they don't have some of these sounds.
Exactly.
Granted, we're going to use Carrie's cute little early speech cards she's going to show you here, and we're going to use...
Whatever, I beat you!
I love it, you beat me.
We're going to use Bjorm speech sound cues. We're going to play. We're going to use environmental sounds to help us expand the sound repertoire. But our focus is going to be the sound the child has. And
exactly.
If this child has minimal sounds in the repertoire, then you need to kind of go back a little bit, scoot back a little bit, and you need to really work on sounds in play. And so kids can begin to understand imitating and really working on sounds in play.
And it may just be vowels. And that's what's so important, is that when we have these minimally verbal kiddos, we're not working on, like how Amy was talking about, you know, working on movement patterns, right? Between syllable, sounds, syllables, words. But you guys, like with the Bjorm speech sound cues and some of my silly sounds cards, they're one sound. Why?
And
because that's the level the child is at. The child
that's
is not
right.
at mama or dada, right? They're at these very simple syllable shapes, which Jenny, I'm sure, will talk about when we do, you know, kind of consider early targets. But go ahead, Jen.
No, you're exactly right, Carrie. And, you know, there's still movement in these.
Yeah, that's a diphthong movement. Exactly. Yeah. That's two movements together.
Which I love, which is my favorite card, right? Because the alligator bites.
The
first diphthong you can get out of most kids because it has meaning. It's a sound, a fairly complex sound, but it has meaning behind it, right? So that is why with toddlers, we start, when we talk about target selection, we start with sound effects. We start with exclamations, right, Jen? We don't start
environmental
with
sounds. Yes. I mean, I'm like, I don't care if you're making the kid pee in the toilet. I don't care if you're making them, whatever it takes, you just get those sounds.
Whatever it takes.
Making it fun, because doing that is fun and kids learn through play.
That's right. And so my therapy is extremely play-based. If you've ever watched any of my therapy sessions, we do it all through play. I mean, you might see me taped up like...
I was just going to say blue tape and Jenny, when I can't look at blue tape now and not think Jenny Bjorm.
Oh, I love it.
Can't live without it. So when it comes to target selection, I always say 10 or less, and they can be words, they can be word combinations, they can be phrases, they can be like an entire sentence or a motor plan that a child may need help with. I did therapy this morning and the dad's like, you know what? He's having trouble with the word apostrophe. That is
heavens.
Yeah. I mean, we're at a higher level.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. No, he's ready for it. We worked on apostrophe today. So it's good when we get to that point.
Yeah.
No, he's not two. He is seven, but But, you know, we worked on apostrophe today. And so that's some of those multisyllabic words. So it doesn't matter what word is if it's important to that child. And my big thing is you have to answer why. So I always talk about this in my, when I present, is I had a family come to me, child has diagnosis of childhood apraxia speech. And I asked, I said, what target words have you been working on? Mom goes, tuna. And I said, is your dog's name tuna? Does your kid love tuna? Do you eat a lot of tuna? Do you fish for tuna? What do you, why?
Right. Tuna? Right. Why is tuna so important in your life?
Yeah. Why? So my question is, right, every time I do a presentation and I have people choose targets, I always say, why? And you have to give me a
love
reason
it.
Why.
Right. I love that.
She couldn't give me a reason why. And I said, no, we don't want to work on it. We can't say hi, bye, mama, or dada.
No.
Or the child's name. Like,
how many names
do we forget to work on the kids? They need to know how to say their own name.
Exactly. Well, and mama, dada, nana, papa, their best friend, their dog, their fish, their teacher, their neighbor's dog. You can come up with your 5 to 10 words just by picking the names
their
of the important
snacks,
people.
Their favorite snack, their favorite show, their favorite thing to eat.
iPad, you better make iPad a first word because almost every kid wants to request iPad.
Peppa Pig.
Oh, Peppa.
Paw Patrol.
Paw Patrol's good one too. Right? I love it.
Dino.
Caregivers, because I had a parent request, like, can we work on the word napkin? Because we use it, she uses it every day and it's just a really hard one. And that never would have occurred to me.
Yeah.
But it's important to that child.
Having parents fill out a wish list. That's what I call it. I want a wish list of words. What words or phrases, you know, I love you. See you later. I don't know. Sometimes they're phrases, right? But what is your wish words? And then as the SLP, so if a parent gives me 30 words on the wish list, I'm going to look at their phonetic inventory. I'm going to see what sounds and what syllable shapes, right, Jenny, are in their inventory currently. And then I'll pick the first 5 target words, but they're coming from the wish list. They're not coming from some commercialized speech therapy program where we're working on words like certificate and transportation. When you start looking at 4-syllable words and tuna, like everybody says, oh, we use the Kaufman program. I have no problem with verbal shaping, which is what Kaufman is all about. But don't tell me you use the Kaufman cards. That's not enough of a, that's not an approach. You know what I mean? Or you're using verbal shaping. That's one verbal cue you can use to simplify the motor plan, but you shouldn't be using the words necessarily from her program. You should be using.
Or flipping through the card deck from one syllable shape.
Yeah, right. That doesn't make any sense.
And that's the other thing. Can I get on my soapbox real quick about syllable shape? You know how many people just choose CVCV words because the child's at the CVCV word level? You are not helping their motor plan. You need CVVC, CVC, CVCV. You need a combination and don't get caught up on a sound. Don't get caught up on a syllable shape. Yeah. Don't get caught up on sounds in when and how they develop. Who cares? We want to know. Go ahead, Amy.
No, I was just going to say, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but. And don't discount a word like a target word just because you think, ooh, that might be a little too tricky. How can you simplify it for that child? I have a very severe apraxic child and her birthday's in October. October, that was a 3-syllable word that we are not producing at all yet. But we got it with lots and lots of cues and principles of motor learning with masked practice and chaining and backward chaining. But we got the word and that was important to them. So I think that's the other thing about syllable shape. Don't just like, well, we can't move on. We can't do this word because that's
because we haven't met all the CVs.
Exactly. Exactly.
So it's not a hierarchy like our tick therapy is. You know what I mean? Yes. In our tick therapy, you start with the sound in isolation and then at the syllable level. And then you go, apraxia therapy isn't really hierarchical. It's more, what's the motor plan for this particular word that is important to this child in the moment? And for me, I don't even necessarily have 5 words. The family knows the 5 words we're focusing on. But for me in therapy, it's what is the kid interested in this moment in time? Jenny, I know that's what you do too, because I watch you follow kids around and just you make the target whatever is appropriate in the moment. And that's the most powerful thing. And that's really what I want to coach parents to do so that you don't feel like, oh, I need more therapy. No, your child needs you to be practicing these skills. Using these strategies at home too, so they get practice every day.
Yeah.
So Jenny, a question I get then from that is, okay, you want me to work on all these different syllable shapes. why? Because therapists, like the way we're trained, I feel like in graduate school is, especially when we are trained in a phonological approach, it's work on this target. Like, let's say it's final consonant deletion. Let's say that that's why the therapist chose CVC, right? So we're trained to be like, okay, great. I have mastery of CVC. Why are you telling people then to change their brain? And I know why, but I'm asking you to set you up like for the answer, which is why do we need to work on a bunch of other syllable shapes with it?
We are working on teaching a new motor plan. So if we teach this child the same motor plan of CV, CV, everything's going to be a CV. Yes.
It's everything. So bad. It's so bad.
So you need to switch it up. So our job is to challenge this motor system so that children are like, oh, that's different. I can do that by myself and I no longer need you. So it's so important. I know even when I was in Istanbul, Kaplan, we were working on sleep, and because it's a real important word when we were playing, and he's like, I'm going to weep, or I don't remember what he was saying, or seep. And I did it in DTTC with him. We did it in simultaneous production with changing our prosody. We did it together. And he goes, no, Den, I can do it. And he wanted to do it all by himself. So I backed off. And he goes, sleep. Like, and I'm like, oh, really great trying. Let me help you one more time. I said, or I think I told him 10 times. I said, remember, if we went 10 times, you are so much closer at getting it by yourself. And he's like, oh, okay. And then we did it together. But like, you know, I'm changing things up because if I, and then what I can do is I can relate it to other ones that we've done, you know, other, you know, I know what I did with him. I related swim to swing. And so I could show them it's a similar motor plan, but I'm not going to just work on those because he needs to know that there's different ones. So he doesn't overgeneralize that to everything else like kids do with apraxia.
Okay. So here's another inbox question. I was taught in graduate school, overgeneralization is a good thing. When a child starts to overgeneralize something that I'm teaching, that means that it'll eventually work itself out, right, Jenny?
No, not with apraxia, because with apraxia, when they overgeneralize, then they're practicing the motor plan wrong. And then that's how they're going to learn it. And so that's where I also kind of get on my soapbox a little bit, is sending homework home to parents too soon who you have not trained the homework.
Yeah.
And I've got a perfect video, you know, where like a parent might be working on, I've had parents send me videos, look, we've worked on this. And that, you know, the child's the parent's not backing up to give them that support in simultaneous production, and the child just practicing times wrong in a video. And so I don't want the child practicing it wrong. I don't want them doing it by themselves. They need 100% support until they can get it 100% correct, and then I'll back off a little bit so that they can do it a little bit more on their own. And our goal is to back up.
And that's so that they can. In early intervention, since I go into the home, you know, and work on parent coaching, we may only be working on mama. You know what I mean? And people are like, you did that for a whole session. I'm like, well, but the parent is practicing and I'm there giving feedback, because my whole goal is, you know, I don't leave homework. I teach the parent how to embed a strategy, but I have to make sure they know how to use the strategy appropriately.
Yeah, because if the child's saying mamu, or if the child's saying ma, ma, or if the child's saying ba, ba, or ba, ma, then and the parents like, they're saying it, but we need it. We want it correct.
Accurate. Right. That's why I can't remember which one of you, one of you amazing people did a post one. I think it might've been Amy. I can't remember now. Maybe you've all talked about this, but like, I don't, keeping data in therapy, I'm like, when it's apraxia, it should be 100%. Like, I'm not 100%. Sure what we're keeping data on. Do you know what I mean? Like,
if your notes say 20% accurate, that's a failed session.
Yes, it is Amy that talked about that recently. That was Amy, yep.
Dynamic cueing, right? The whole point of, and that's why DTTC, if you're an SLP and you aren't using DTTC, stop everything and go take the free,
it's free!
Go use!
So you need doing, it's so simple and it makes so much sense.
And it'll change your life. And you know what? Gosh, I love Edith Strand. It'll change your life. It's easy.
After you understand it, you can't not.
Yeah. Right.
In fact, so I was I was talking with Brianna from Child Apraxia Treatment, which is a private foundation. I did a Zoom with her, and she specializes in apraxia in Dallas. And she was saying too, that even when her kids get to that ESPLEN level, Jenny, like you were just talking about, sometimes some things are really difficult and you can't get it. And so when they brainstorm, they have a saying in their clinic that's like, I DTTC'd it.
Yes.
I loved it. I was like, oh, I like that. I DTTC'd it. I'm going to start saying that
now. Go back and hold both the kids, both their hands, and pick them up. That's what you're doing. You're carrying.
Yeah.
But without simultaneous. Without simultaneous production, people who aren't using simultaneous production, you know, that for, I'm like, you have to.
It's so powerful.
It's how you help them
and slow it down.
Yeah.
Oh, the face-to-face, you have to be face-to-face, mirror neurons. I mean, it's all just DTTC is so wonderful. And it's just important that SLPs understand, you know, what it is and are using it. And then if you're struggling, we're here for you. Right.
Like, Carrie, like you
I'm going to back up really quick. Can I back up really quick? I just want to on target selection and going back to what Carrie said, she's down here in this corner of my screen.
She's up here for me.
wherever Carrie is. In your
the Brady Bunch.
100% accuracy. My goals are not 70%. My goals are not 80%. My goals are not 85%. My goals are not written at 90%. If a child gets it at 85% or 90%, they do not have that as a
motor plan.
They have not gained that motor plan. It has to be written goals on IEPs, goals in, for children with apraxia. If you are working on a motor plan, it has to be 100% accuracy. No, nothing else. So
yeah, apraxia goals, they say something like, you know, Joey will accurately plan and sequence. And I don't even put a percentage. I just said they will plan and sequence. And that's how I write it. That's what motor planning is. We're getting it.
I have a rubric on my website that I use. And so I just say that they have to get to a 1, which is 100%. Yeah. That means spontaneously producing the target. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, it has to be 100% accuracy.
Which is why put down the clipboard.
Yeah.
Don't take data throughout your session.
Stop taking data.
Yeah. Take a data. I think you were talking about my post about like data is not therapy. Mm-hmm. Especially for apraxia.
Yeah. I like your idea, Amy, though, of do a baseline. You know, when they first come in, if you want to take data on your 10 target words spontaneously or an imitation, however you want to do it, and get some data there, then do your therapy. And then at the end, if you want to probe, you know, 5 of those target words with no cueing and see what happens, by all means do that. But don't sit there and focus on pluses and minuses the whole time. Cause then how are you cueing the child? How are you face to face? How are you actually doing? Yeah. Yeah. So
don't do it.
Well, we have 2 minutes. We're officially at the 2 minute mark. We guys can talk forever. I'm just going to do a round robin. I was going to do a topic on comorbidities, and you guys, unfortunately, I have a post on my website that is apraxia, unfortunately, is a foreshadowing of potential other disorders to come because speech tends to be the first thing that gets recognized. So SLPs can really do a lot of help for a family by being able to recognize that there are concomitant conditions that can happen and referring to the appropriate professionals. So I would say the one that I just got recently was, you know, how do I help my CAS kid potty train? Potty training, as much as it seems like it should have something to do with motor planning, does not. Like that doesn't have to do with speech apraxia, could have everything to do with sensory processing disorder, with dyspraxia, with not being that interception where you feel it inside. Interoception. Yeah. So I would say that's one thing, you know, sensory processing disorder and dyspraxia. You know, we want to be referring to OTs and PTs. I'm going to go over this way to Carrie. There we go. Yeah.
Coolest
so Carrie, what's another comorbidity?
Yeah, this is, interoception. The sensory component is huge. Yeah. So you want me to talk about a potential comorbidity?
Well, we only have 1 minute. So let's just go around robin and talk about just a comorbidity to apraxia. Go.
There's going to be likely reading, writing, and spelling difficulties, language-based academic difficulties later on. So you don't want parents to be surprised by that.
Perfect. Amy.
Expressive language.
There we go, Jenny. Yeah, go ahead. No, Jenny, go ahead. That's fine.
Expressive language.
Yes, expressive language. Yes.
100%. And I was just going to kind of echo what Carrie said about literacy. It needs to be on our radar because with all speech sound disorders, those kids are at higher risk for literacy deficits.
So if you guys want to get a hold of any of us, I said the social media handles for everyone at the beginning. Thank you all so much for joining. Or at Beorum Speech. Okay. Thank you. Yes. And thank you everyone for joining this special edition of Praxia Awareness Day Zoom. We'll see you soon.
Bye guys.
Bye. Thanks.